Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. What's it like to be a foreign correspondent? Well, we're about to find out. Alexis Okewo has worked in Nigeria, Uganda, and Mexico, freelancing for various publications, the New York Times Magazine, Bloomberg Businessweek, and the Financial Times. She's been a staff writer at the New Yorker since 2015 and is currently working on a book, A Moonless, Starless Sky, Women and Men Fighting Extremism in Africa. A graduate of Princeton University, Alexis was a Princeton in Africa Fellow in 2006-07, working at the New Vision newspaper in Uganda, her first job. In Fitting In, an article she wrote for the Princeton Alumni Weekly, she described herself as a rare creature, an African-American living in East Africa. Alexis's family is from Nigeria, but she was born and raised in Montgomery, Alabama. Alexis was a finalist for the 2015 Livingston Award for Young Journalists and the 2014 Kurt Schork Award in International Journalism. She is the recipient of a 2013 Pulitzer Center grant and a 2012 Alicia Patterson Foundation Fellow writing about gay rights in Africa. Alexis, welcome and thanks for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, I gotta go here. Born and raised in Montgomery, Alabama. Why and what was that like?
Well, actually, I was born in Houston, Texas. My parents, who are both Nigerian, each emigrated to the U.S. Within a few years of each other, and they both ended up in college in Alabama. So they met there and then for various degrees and jobs traveled throughout the South, moving around. When they're in Texas, they had me, and then shortly thereafter, we went back to Alabama. And yeah, I'm a Southern girl, I have to say.
Yes. Was that, to the best of your knowledge, a fairly easy adjustment for your parents to be in the Deep South?
I don't think so at all. No, I think it was a culture shock, especially at that time. It was the tail end of the civil rights movement. You know, they're coming from a place where race really wasn't an issue into a place where it was the issue.
Hello, yeah.
Right. And so, you know, I think they eventually adjusted and they found, you know, friends and people who they could lean on. But oddly enough, there were, you know, quite a few African immigrants in the South at the time attending school. And so, yeah, they weren't the only Nigerians. They weren't the only Africans there.
Life in Montgomery, Alabama was fine for you.
It was. And, you know, there was some, definitely a lot of cultural elements of Nigeria in my home. My mom cooked the food all the time. You know, my parents, as I said, had Nigerian friends. So they would have celebrations where they played Nigerian music. And, you know, so you felt like you had an injection of the Nigerian culture, but I didn't feel particularly an ownership of it.
Did they take you to Nigeria?
Once, when I was 11, for about 2 weeks, for a Christmas holiday.
So you obviously still had extended family in Nigeria,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a lot.
And your parents are still in the States?
They're still in Alabama, yes.
How did you wind up at Princeton? I mean, now that's also a big geographical jump.
It is. I mean, I remember when in high school when I was applying for college, you know, I was only had a few friends who were even thinking about leaving the state. It just wasn't done. You know, you kind of tend to stay close to home. But I always knew, I think maybe it's because my parents are foreign. They've always been interested and made us interested in the world that I wanted to get out of the South for college. I wanted to see.
Try somewhere else.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I applied to a bunch of places all over the country. And Princeton turned out to just be the right fit.
Do you have other siblings?
I do have two younger brothers.
And they're scattered too?
Yeah, one's in LA, one's in Miami. Mm-hmm. So we've all kind of
spread our wings.
Exactly.
Yeah. While at Princeton, is that when you decided that you wanted to be a writer or a journalist? And if yes, is it your calling or mission?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in high school, I realized that I liked writing.
And you were good at it?
Yeah, and that I was good at it. Yeah, that was when I first realized that. But I wasn't sure. It's still, my father's actually a journalism professor.
The acorn?
Exactly. And then when I was in college, I wrote for the paper, you know, alternative campus publication. And I thought, oh, wow, this is something I could do. I wasn't sure where or how I would do it, but I thought this is something that's exciting, the reporting, talking to people.
Was it political what you were doing?
Not really. I mean, it was sort of just like daily news, social reporting. I studied politics, but I was doing more sort of social and news type reporting, which I just found interesting because just being able to talk to people and listen.
And ask questions.
Exactly.
Yeah, I understand that.
That's my favorite part.
I agree with that as a journalist also because people have fascinating stories to share. So you get to Princeton and you kind of hone your skills?
I do, yeah. Princeton didn't have journalism as a major, but you could work on the newspaper, work on different magazines. And I was doing that and enjoying it a lot. And then after my junior year, I interned at a newspaper in Harlem, which was an interesting experience. Because I never lived in New York. You know, my first day, my editor says, go cover this murder in Brooklyn. And I'm like, where's Brooklyn? You
know? Right. Once you got your feet wet, it felt like a good match for you?
It did. It did. I felt, especially with that internship, that I was being pushed to.
And mentored?
Yeah. Yes, because it's a very small newspaper, as the New York Amsterdam News.
Oh, well, that's not such a small news.
Well, I mean, in a sense, compared to maybe
compared to what?
I guess the Times.
All right, no. That's a potent publication.
No, it is. Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah, so I think that really convinced me.
What year did you graduate?
2006.
And that's when you became a Princeton in Africa fellow.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. Explain it, and how did that happen, and what did it mean?
Yeah, so Princeton in Africa was all about, or still is, placing recent graduates in nonprofits across the continent. It's a year to get experience working at an organization in Africa. And I was interested in Africa, but it wasn't the priority for me at the time. I wanted a job in journalism.
Let me interrupt and ask, was there a program like Princeton in Asia?
There is a Princeton in Asia.
So it covers the world.
Totally. All yeah. Right. And a Princeton in Latin America. I remember meeting with the editor in New York right before I graduated and just realizing that there weren't necessarily a lot of jobs out there in New York for what I wanted to do as
an
entry-level reporter.
What did you want to do?
Yeah, I wanted to be an entry-level reporter at a magazine or a newspaper. I mean, I didn't care, actually. Just any kind of reporting.
You didn't want to do soft news?
No, I didn't want to do soft news. I didn't want to do entertainment or anything, but I just wanted to.
So you didn't feel that you had a lot of options for you?
Exactly, yeah. And I even got the sense from him. He was even implying, I should try being freelance in it. And that was pretty scary. So I remember, looking at all the postings Princeton in Africa had, and they had two journalism ones. And I thought, okay, if I can get one of those, then that would be worth it to go and try it out.
But what did that mean for you monetarily?
Right. So luckily with our organization, they do give you enough of a stipend to live and work in these countries. Because usually a lot of them are not very expensive to live in. So yeah, I knew if I could get one of those fellowships that I would be taken care of for the next year.
So there were two options in Africa, one in Uganda, and the other one
is in South Africa.
In South Africa. So you applied or you just got?
No, I applied.
You applied.
Yes.
And then what happened?
And then I thought, oh wow, Uganda. I don't know anything about Uganda. First, I called my parents, and they're sort of shocked. They thought I was going to law school the next year.
Yeah, that's a bit of a shock.
Right. And they said, okay, fine, you can defer for 1 year. They were worried. Huh. They were worried because at least they knew Uganda is a stable country, but it was so far, and they weren't exactly sure what I was going to be doing, even though it's supposed to be, an intern at a newspaper there.
Were there people who were going to, and I use the term in quotes, take care of you?
Yeah, the coordinator of the fellowship was this British editor who the people at Princeton Africa knew well, and he had worked with past interns.
So here you are from Princeton. Is there somebody from Penn or?
Well, there are actually two other Princeton people who were doing two different other jobs in Uganda. So one was working at an HIV NGO, and another one was working at one that dealt with children. And so at least there would be three of us together living in an apartment, working at our various jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So that seemed very comforting.
So you were in the capital city?
Yes, in Kampala.
Kampala, I couldn't remember the name.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's a lovely city. I mean, once I got there, I felt more at ease.
So do you have an independent streak? Considering you lived in Alabama and went to college in the Northeast and you're not around the corner. So you're a fairly independent person.
Yeah. And, when I was at Princeton, I studied abroad in London, and it kind of let me know I could do it.
So what was the experience like?
One of my roommates is already there, so that was nice. She had helped set up the apartment. I went to my job straight away a few days later, met my boss. Everyone was very welcoming. I was straight away paired with senior reporters, following them, doing what I thought was really exciting stuff, actually. Reporting on environmental stories, on political stories, on human rights. And then eventually being able to just do my own stories. You know, they were very open. They said, pitch us and you can go ahead and report on your own. And it felt very free. It felt very liberating. And I felt like I was learning a lot.
Did you stay only in Uganda?
For the first 9 months, yes, while I was in the internship.
And but they didn't send you out of the country to cover stories?
No, but they sent me all over the country, though. You know, there were a few trips I went on alone, a few in the beginning where there was another reporter. Sometimes there would be a photographer. But yeah, there are a bunch that I did on my own. But I mean, you know, Uganda is a very safe country. And so I never had a situation where I felt.
But it also sounds like you have a very strong sense of self.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I always wonder whether that veers too much into unnecessary risk taking. But I've always felt like.
I think as a foreign correspondent, that's a given.
Right.
I really do. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Alexis Okewo, who is a foreign correspondent. Okay, your year's up. You come home. Now what?
Well, I mean, even before I came home, I knew I wasn't really going to come home. I had.
What does home mean? You mean Alabama?
Or the U.S., really.
Or the U.S.,
yeah.
Okay.
I had made friends with some other journalists, foreign correspondents in Uganda, and they were just advising me on ways I could still, because I realized I want to stay in Africa. I want to keep doing foreign correspondence. And they said, well, even after your internship ends, you can freelance. Try working with these places. They gave me some contacts.
And local contacts or working with a United Press International or Associated Press?
Similar. I remember my first freelance client was a newspaper in South Africa, The Mail and Guardian. And then from there, you know, the Christian Science Monitor and Time.com. And I slowly started doing, building up work that way.
And still staying in Uganda.
And still staying in Uganda. Because I already had a home by then.
I was going to say,
it was easier. And so by the time I went back the next summer for vacation, you know.
In 2007?
In 2007, you know, I think my parents were already aware of the, at that point.
That law school was off the radar.
Yeah, at least for that time. Mm-hmm. And so I went back for another year. And actually, at that time, I started working for the Agence France-Presse, the French mm-hmm. news agency. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I started traveling. At the end of 2007, there was a very chaotic presidential election in Kenya that erupted into violence for a few months. And I went there with AFP to report for a few months. So it was nice to sort of to branch out of Uganda and cover new stories.
So as you get more of this experience under your belt, and we'll mm-hmm. talk some more about the jobs that you've gotten, I'm curious as to what it was like to be a woman basically in a man's field, a young woman?
Right. Yeah. I mean, especially at the newspaper where I started out. It was
in Uganda.
Yeah, it was very stark. And it was dealing with this balance of A, wanting to be taken seriously and also being friendly with your colleagues and then having to deflect or deal with the fact that, you know, some senior male colleagues would treat you.
Get coffee, Alexis?
Right, exactly. Or make inappropriate comments where they're like, oh, they want to take you out for a drink when, you know, you have no interest in that. You mm-hmm. just want to work together. And and so it was a constant balance of that. And I think that kind of became less intense after I left, but it stayed.
Left Uganda?
After I left the newspaper.
The newspaper.
But
okay.
I think it stayed. Even when you're dealing with colleagues, especially ones who you're trying to learn from.
Did anybody have your back?
I think friends, really, because I think as a freelancer, you really feel out, you know, you're out there. You're kind of out there alone. And so you kind of support, you kind of rely on friends who are female friends who are also in the same situation.
In that same vein, the fact that you were freelancing and were not on staff of the New York Times, mm-hmm. who was going to take care of you if there was a problem? Do you know what I mean?
Right.
That's a whole other mindset.
I mean, to be honest, I didn't even think about that back then. You know, I mean, because when I was doing the internship, I, you know, of course, Prince in Africa had me on their insurance. You know, there could have been so many situations, I feel like, as I said, when I was covering the violent election in Kenya, where things could have gone wrong. And, you know, I'm sure AFP or someone would have pitched in. But technically, no one was responsible for me.
You're on your own.
I was on my own. And I think, you know, looking back now, I'm just grateful nothing did happen because now, you know, where I am now, I would never do that. I would never just.
Do you think that part of it was just luck? You were lucky?
Yes.
But you also did work in Nigeria, right?
I did. That was later on.
And that's also Boko Haram country.
Yes. And I was also freelance at the time as well.
What was that like? And let's talk about the organization for those who.
Yeah, Boko Haram is an insurgent group that formed around 2001 in northern Nigeria. And they claim that their goal is to bring about Sharia law in Nigeria, that they want Nigeria to be an Islamic state. And so they've been waging a very brutal rebellion since about 2009, where they've been killing thousands of people, abducting them, you know, doing the worst kind of things to people, forcing them to flee from their homes, all as part of some bigger campaign to overturn.
And you covered them?
The government, yes.
And
yes.
What was that like?
Yeah, I mean—
Wasn't it terrifying, especially being a female reporter and they have such disdain for women?
Right. I mean, what I tried to really focus on was how sort of everyday people were affected by the group. But when it did get dangerous was when I was reporting on the girls, the almost 300 schoolgirls who were abducted by the group in 2014. And just going at that point to see those girls, to see their families— in a zone that was sort of nominally held by Boko Haram, it was scary. But you kind of felt like, or I felt like, a duty to go report because by virtue of it being so isolated, there was very little report news coming from there. There were very little news reports from on the ground in that area. And, you know, Africa, by virtue of what it is now, is already undercovered. And so, you know, I felt a connection to this story, to this people. You know, my family's Nigerian. And I just felt like a special emotional connection to that story of these girls who were just trying to take exams and then—
Did you ever worry for your own safety?
I did, but I tried to do as much as I could to
protect yourself,
exactly.
So to speak.
You know, I was working with someone who was from that town, and we were traveling together. From the town where the girls were abducted, and we were traveling together and trying to do things in the safest way as possible.
Was language an issue for you at all?
Yes, in that particular area, yes. But the guide I was working with was my translator, and that was good. And I kind of just sort of dressed in a certain way and kept as silent as I could so I didn't stand out in public.
How much connection did you have with family members?
When I was living there, I saw them, you know, for looking, I have aunts and uncles and cousins.
So that must have been an interesting experience to get to know these people who basically you didn't know or met once when you were 11 years old.
It was very interesting. I mean, being there, though, I mean, I have to say it was an invaluable time because it was a time when I felt like I became Nigerian as well as being
American.
Well,
you wrote about that in that article that I quoted about the fact that it was such an anomaly for you.
Right. Because I had been used to being an African-American reporter in Africa, which is pretty rare.
Right.
And Africans sort of being confused, being like, well, are you African? Are you American? Right. You know, we thought all Americans were white. And then being in a country where actually I am of that country— in addition to being American, but it didn't feel as confusing. I just felt a kinship to both in a way, which was nice. I felt my connection to Nigeria deepen. And I think that improved my reporting on that country.
Was that the most challenging of your jobs?
Definitely.
Being in Nigeria.
Definitely.
And how does Mexico fit into this?
Yeah, Mexico. Mexico was an interesting interlude. That actually came about because I'd wanted to move to Cuba after I left Uganda. I had wanted to be in a place that was more newsy, that I felt people were more interested
in. What year was that?
That was 2008. I went for a few weeks, but they didn't let me stay, I guess unsurprisingly. And then I ended up in Mexico City, which is a fascinating place. I mean, Mexico is an incredible
and
country.
And you stayed there for a year?
I stayed there for about 2 years.
For 2 years. And who did you work for there?
Everybody. Yeah, I was writing a lot for the San Francisco Chronicle, Newsweek, Time.com.
And how do you get the freelance jobs? People just read you and then hire
you? No.
Not that easy.
No, I wish. No, I had to be very proactive. I mean, I think it's easier now because on social media, a lot of editors are online and they post their emails. Back then, you know, I would be doing intense Googling to find who the editor of this section was, what their email is, and then sending blind pitches and then following up as much as I could until someone finally said yes. And then after, you know, working with someone a couple of times, you know, you have
you
that
get your street cred.
Exactly.
And there was never a time when you thought to myself, what am I doing?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So in my second year of being in Mexico, just by virtue of I mean, the difficulties of freelancing, you know, you get paid, but it's always late.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things are just so unstable. I thought, I want to leave this for a while, and I just want to work in an organization, at a news organization, and see what it's like from the other side. And so
because you're talking about 8 years of doing this.
Yeah.
Nonstop.
Right.
You lived overseas from 2006 to 2014.
Yes. Well, except for this interlude. In 2010, in my second year in Mexico, you know, I was sick of freelancing. I wanted to join an organization. So actually, I moved to New York for a year and a half, and I became an editorial assistant at The New Yorker. You know, at first I thought, oh my God, this is so boring. I want to be out in the field. But I actually learned a lot, seeing it from the other side, seeing how stories came in, were shaped, how they were pitched. And it was a really important experience. So that when I left again.
Why'd you leave?
I left because
Wanderlust?
Yes, I missed it. I missed reporting. You know, it was very frustrating to be able to sit down in New York and see stories you feel like you should be covering.
Overseas?
Yes.
So you went after that year? You went where?
So then 2012, I went to Nigeria.
For 2 years.
Right.
And then why'd you leave?
Well, it was kind of like the opposite of the feeling I felt then, because I was starting a book, this book that you mentioned. And I felt like I needed to be in a place where I could just sort of think and write in a place that felt more calm, where I just felt like I could think and breathe. I mean, Nigeria, Lagos is a dynamic, fascinating city, but it's not, I wouldn't describe it as a calm place. I wouldn't describe it as a place where you necessarily you feel like you have a lot of freedom just to sit, ruminate. You know, and I knew I would be visiting Nigeria a lot after that, but I was
Well, it's also maybe something that had to do with your mental stay
so.
Too. Did you also want to maybe build a different kind of normalcy?
Yeah, I mean, I was really missing being so far from my family, actually.
That too, I'm sure.
And from friends who I'd had for a very long time who were in this area, even though, of course, I have friends over there as well. And yeah, I was missing that kind of feeling of settledness that I never
Sometimes
quite...
wanderlust can be hard,
yes.
You know, when you don't have roots somewhere.
Exactly. And as much as I love Nigeria and felt like I made a home out of it, I didn't feel settled, properly settled there.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Alexis Okewo, who is a foreign correspondent. So you come back and now you go on your own to The New Yorker? Because
yeah.
You had, you know, a history with them.
I had a history with them. And then last year, you know, I started talking with the editor there and sort of expressing my interest and hoping to come back full time as a writer. And, you know, after some months, it worked out and we were able to...
Agree.
Yes.
And so what do you do there?
I write a lot for the web and for the print magazine on...
Are you assigned stories?
I would say about half, maybe 50-50. And as of now, you know, some are from Africa, but some are not. You know, ones I'm working on a story from Mexico right now. Another story, a domestic story. So yeah, so it's a combination of topics, but still with an mostly international focus.
Bent. When you pitch a story, is it often accepted?
Yes, but only because I kind of know what will be accepted and won't be accepted now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just by virtue of me pitching something doesn't mean it will get accepted. But I think I know now what works as a story, especially as a New Yorker story.
Well, I think of one of them that I when I was reading about you, the title of an article, A Jazz Singer Fights Niagara
right.
Bottling.
Right.
I mean, that can
right.
be more diametrically opposed. For argument's sake, how did that come to pass?
Well, actually, that came about from another New Yorker writer, Hilton Ellis. He suggested this idea to me because he knew that I am, you know, not only just want to do international stories now, but other things too. And he thought, oh, why don't you try this? And I thought, oh, it is interesting because even though it's a very local story, there are elements of it that I'm drawn to. You know, this woman fighting for justice for her town against a corporation that really doesn't care about her community's needs.
What is she fighting?
Well, she was fighting against a water bottling company that wanted to come into her area and, you know, start drawing water from the wells, and it looked like there would be environmental
issues,
hazards.
Oh, hazards. Mm-hmm.
And also potential economic
impact
mm-hmm. on her. And mm-hmm. so by community organizing, they were able to push this this company away. And not only that, they've been able to help other communities around the country also fight back against this company and other similar companies.
Do you ever write any articles that are a little bit more frivolous?
Yeah. I mean, actually, I'm working on it. Well, I don't want to call it frivolous, but it's more fun.
Yeah, more fun.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm actually working.
Not as serious.
Yes.
That's a better way to describe it.
Not often enough, but I am working on a story right now about a music video director, which has been very fun because she's created a lot of videos that have resonated with a lot of young people today. And so it's been fun to talk about culture and music in that way. Mm-hmm. And I realize how important it is to do a story like that every once in a while, even just for your mental health.
I was going to say your own mental health. Exactly.
You know? Mm-hmm. You know, and it was also fun doing a story about an orchestra in the Congo last year. You know, even though the Congo has its own political problems, which I talked about a little bit, just writing about this orchestra was really fun.
Now, did you have to go there?
I did. I went to Congo.
And did you write this article for The New Yorker?
Yes.
And they sent you?
Yes.
So that's a whole other mindset.
Right.
I would imagine.
Right.
And kind of not living in the lap of luxury, but in comparison,
totally.
Yes.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you still have wanderlust?
I do.
Do you see yourself going abroad for The New Yorker without, you know, saying, or do you want to leave at some point? What do you see yourself doing in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, I see myself still, you know, hopefully going abroad for The New Yorker for certain stories. You know, not all the times I was before. You know, when I was living in Nigeria, I was constantly on the road. I mean, I, you know, kind of living out of two suitcases. But, you know, having, you know, a situation where, you know, I'm going, you know, maybe a couple times a year, mm-hmm. to do stories. But then being able to come back here and sort of write it. And
give us an update on how your book is going.
Right.
That sounds like quite an undertaking. And let me mention the title again, A Moonless, Starless Sky, Women and Men Fighting Extremism in Africa.
Yeah, that came about because through my reporting in Africa, I kind of noticed that there were all these characters who were doing sometimes extraordinary, sometimes just ordinary things to stand up against extreme circumstances they found themselves in, whether it was people living under Boko Haram or Al-Shabaab in Somalia, the terrorist group there, or people who, even more extreme, who are in Mauritania where slavery still exists, but who are just ordinary people who had interesting lives but were doing these extraordinary things to kind of fight for themselves. To survive. Yeah, exactly. Just to survive. And so I chose a few of those people and I really kind of spent time with them to get into their histories, talk about how they grew up, kind of get us the story of who they were, and then talk about what they're doing.
So were these people freedom fighters?
One, I would say, expressly is because Zine is an activist, but the others aren't activists. They're kind of just ordinary people who, by virtue of the choices they made, ended up kind of rebelling against whatever system they were forced. I mean, you know, one example is one of the girls who was kidnapped in Nigeria by Boko Haram, and she escaped, and now she's back in school. And she's not an activist, but by virtue of her being back in school
In Nigeria,
which was what she was kidnapped for, is like, you know, extraordinary in and of itself.
And you met her.
Yeah, and she's part of the book. And, you know, on the other side of that, there's a man also in northern Nigeria, who was so fed up with the violence there caused by the terrorists and also by the relative inaction of the military against them, that he took up arms along with thousands of other men and started this vigilante movement to fight Boko Haram. So it's kind of a spread of characters.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
We've run out of time, okay. But I so enjoyed getting to know you and meeting you.
Same.
And you have such a wonderful story to tell and to share verbally.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure. Lots of continued luck and just keep writing.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women, and please go to our iTunes store page and leave a rating and a review. And if you know anyone you think that we should interview, contact us at sandyclineshow.com. Celebration of the joy.